Okay, brethren, for some weeks now we've been looking at the Gospel of Matthew, and I guess we're coming around into the home straight now. We're in Matthew chapter 23. We just started looking at chapter 23 last week, so we pick up pretty much there. The point we'd sort of finished on was slightly puzzling verses that Jesus spoke in verses 2 and 3. He's speaking to the multitude, the people at large, and he says, "The scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do." And on the face of it, sounds like Jesus is saying, yep, these guys are your leaders. These guys are experts in the Word of God. You should do what they say. Now, of course, that would be rather puzzling because the Pharisees basically hated Jesus, hated his Word, did not understand or believe who he was. These guys were super-duper self-righteous. We'll see in the balance of chapter 25 just how many times Jesus puts almost a curse on them. And equally, last time we read, just before we finished in Matthew 16, we're not turning there today, where Jesus said to his disciples, "Beware the leaven of the Pharisees," meaning beware their doctrine, beware their teaching. So therefore, verses 2 and 3 can't mean what on the surface they appear to mean. It is inconsistent with the rest of the text of the chapter and Matthew and even the New Testament. The Pharisees are the guys who made the Word of God of none effect by their many traditions. And we saw last week that two changes we can make legitimately. One is in verse 2. We can say the scribes and Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. That's the way the New American Standard Bible translates it. These guys usurped that authority. It's not God-given. They just think they're so great that, God's lucky to have them. So that's verse 2. And verse 3, the Greek. Obviously, we're reading a translation in English, or this could be Spanish or French, but in English, the translation is from the Greek, and the Greek words can be translated in two different ways. Both ways are entirely acceptable as translations. You have to decide which translation makes sense from the context. One translation is in verse 3, whatever they tell you, observe and do it, which is a command. That's what they call the imperative. The other is the indicative, and that simply is a description of the facts. In other words, whatever they tell you to observe, that you are observing and doing. Because that's what people did do. They looked to the Pharisees. These were pious men, men of God, dog collars on, that sort of stuff. And so we could translate verse 3, verses 2 and 3, because the scribes and Pharisees have seated themselves in Moses' seat, therefore you are observing and doing whatever they tell you. And then Jesus says, but you shouldn't. So let's pick up at that point. Verse 3, I'll read it in the indicative rather than the imperative. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that ye observe and do, but do not do according to their works. So they say, and do not do. And let's carry on now. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. They're actually hard taskmasters. Verse 5. But all their works they do to be seen by men. Remember, they would toot their trumpets when they were doing works of charity, so as you could see them. They would stand in the at the busy thoroughfares with their hands up in the air, so as you could see they were praying. When they fasted, they made sure they looked pretty miserable, so as you could tell they were fasting. Verse 5, all their works they do to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. So these were some of the emblems of being religious. Tassels on the hem of your clothes, these little boxes that they tied to their forearms or foreheads, make them big so folk can see them. Verse 6, they love the best places, or margin, the places of honour at feasts. They love the best seats in the synagogues. They love greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. You know, these guys are, you know, so important in their own eyes, and they are vain with a capital V. But you, Jesus talking to his disciples, basically, you don't pay attention to their teaching. You beware the leaven of the Pharisees. You don't do what they tell you, because, we'll just see in a moment, they teach nonsense. And don't imitate them. Verse 8, but you do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. Obviously, we each have a physical father, but Jesus is talking about people who want to be looked up to, people who want to be perceived as religious guides. And of course, there's one major denomination whose priests and leaders are referred to as Father. And of course, a man sitting in the Vatican who is referred to as Holy Father. But that's not what Jesus said to do. At verse 10, do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ, the Messiah. But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself will be abased. He who humbles himself will be exalted. And of course, the Pharisees exalted themselves. Best places at the feasts, best seats in the synagogue. People, you know, bowing down to them. Oh, Rabbi, Rabbi, Reverend Rabbi, all that stuff. And then Jesus starts in verse 13 with eight woes, eight sort of curses. Now, you wouldn't really want Jesus to be staring at you with his eyes aflame, announcing a curse upon you, a woe upon you. But that's what Jesus does now. Remember, this stage, we're in the final week of Jesus' ministry. That began, I think, back in chapter 21 or thereabouts. So we're now several days into Jesus' final week. He's holding nothing back now. It's, you know, both barrels. Verse 13, but woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, pretenders. Hypocrites know they're putting on a false image. That's why they're hypocrites. They're deliberately and knowingly pretending. It's all a show. It's all vanity. For you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. So just think a moment in the context. So Jesus would really have been saying, yeah, yeah, whatever the Pharisees tell you, you make sure you do that, because they're sitting in Moses' seat. It's a nonsense, isn't it? Because verse 8 says, these guys aren't going into the kingdom. And they're making sure you don't go in either. So certainly, we're not to follow the example or the teaching of Pharisees. Verse 14, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Now, if it's the case that many Pharisees, or most Pharisees, understood that they were hypocrites, pretenders, and they knew it, then they will be in serious trouble eternally. Have to be, because, you know, many would have known who Jesus was, the Messiah. Just sort of refused to admit it to themselves, certainly refused to acknowledge it to anybody else. And it says they devour widows' houses. That's, in other words, you know, widows who are often, you know, frail, don't have perhaps people to look after their interests. So here come the Pharisees, and they're going to talk about how pious they are, how important they are, how this widow lady needs to really make sure she leaves them her property in her will so that it can come to the Pharisees to do good things with it. We've heard that in the churches of God. Widow ladies and widowers who are encouraged to make sure, don't leave your home to your children or your grandchildren. They're just wasted. Make sure you give that money to us so as we can, you know, do something really important, whatever that might be. Verse 15, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell, as Gehenna, as yourselves. So again, did Jesus mean, oh yeah, whatever they tell you, make sure you do it? No. They're turning people into hell. Woe to you, blind guides. Oh, again, these guys know the word of God. They know the truth. Pay attention to them. No. Woe to you, blind guides. Now, if you were making your way through a dangerous area, perhaps a swamp, or perhaps if you're in the military, you know, through a minefield where all sorts of devices have been, you know, set by the enemy, would you like a blind person to guide you through that? Don't think so. And as far as Jesus is concerned, these guys are blind. Who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And they also said, whoever swears by the altar, it's nothing. But whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. These were the teachings, the doctrine, the leaven of the Pharisees. And Jesus said, you know, what stupidity. Verse 19, fools, blind, for which is greater, the gift? Obviously not, or the altar that sanctifies the gift. Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it. So the rules of the Pharisees were just complete, no, absolute nonsense. Pathetic. Verse 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. These, former, you ought to have done, without leaving the others undone. So see, these guys, you know, petty, they're going to go out there and think, I've got, 20 leaves of mint on my mint plant. I must make sure I tithe two of those leaves. Pluck, pluck. Fastidious about minutiae. But says Jesus, hang on guys, the really important things, how you live with other people, justice, mercy, faith or faithfulness. Now, you're ignoring the majors and you are, you know, mastering the minors. That's not the way to do it. Verse 24, blind guides, once again, who strain out a gnat and yet swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so you also outwardly appear righteous to men. I mean, God wasn't fooled. but inside you're full of hypocrisy, ooh, and lawlessness. Despite their pious appearance, they were commandment breakers. And so they looked the part, just like a whitened sepulchre, a whitewashed tomb. Looks okay on the outside, nice fancy stonework, and if it's newly whitewashed, the sun shining on it looks, bright and could look, attractive and interesting. But if you open up a tomb, well, what have you got? Decay, stench, dead bones, death. And that's what these guys, that's what Jesus said they were like. The appearance was there, but the heart, rank, stinking, evil. Verse 29, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets, adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, 'If we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets.'" Of course they would. They were planning to have Jesus executed in just about 3 or 4 days' time. Again, it's hypocrisy. Verse 31, "Therefore you are witnesses against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt. Serpents, brood of vipers, you snakes, how can you escape the condemnation of Gehenna?" And I'm not sure they do. I'm not the judge, thankfully. But when you read about the Pharisees and what they did and the fact they were hypocrites and pretenders, and they knew a lot more than they ever admitted, and there's certainly several places here Jesus talks of condemning them. I'm not saying for sure, but there's got to be at least a significant chance that these guys will be in the lake of fire. Verse 34, "Therefore, indeed, I send you prophets, wise men, and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." And as it happens, of course, about 40 years later, this generation, with lots of these Pharisees around, were pretty much destroyed by the Romans. Verse 37. And in Luke's version, by the way, it says here that Jesus wept, because Jesus knew it didn't have to be this way. If people would humble themselves and accept, God's offer, or all the times that God sent prophet after prophet after prophet saying to people, come back to me, stop going after other gods and committing spiritual adultery, come back to me, but they wouldn't. And so Jesus wept. He just knew the consequences. Verse 37, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing." Some people say that because God is sovereign, God always gets what God wants. Well, no, he doesn't. Because God has given to human beings a very great amount of free will and power to make choices and decide, and he will definitely say, choose life. That's what Moses said way back in Deuteronomy. "I've set before you, I'm calling heaven and earth to record this day against you. I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Now choose, and choose life." And of course, that was God's will. That was God's desire. That was God's instruction. That's what God wanted, and that's not what God got, because the people of Israel, like people today, chose curses and death. And Jesus says here, how many times over the centuries did I want to reach out and protect you like a mother hen her little chicks? That was my desire, That's what I wanted to do. But unfortunately, it ends that verse, you were not willing. You chose otherwise. Verse 38, see, as a consequence, your house is left to you desolate. And 40 or so years later, it was completely desolate. We'll pick up some of that in the next chapter. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So that, I think, ends chapter 23. And on to chapter 24. I think we said probably a couple of months back when we started, there are five lengthy-ish discourses in the Gospel of Matthew. There was Matthew 5, 6, and 7. That was the Sermon on the Mount. Quite a long discourse that Jesus gave to his disciples. Lots of practical teaching. There was chapter 10. Jesus gave a discourse there to his disciples as they were sent off on a mission. There was chapter 13. That was another of the five discourses about kingdom parables. There was chapter 18, another discourse about offenses and forgiveness. And here we come to the fifth and final discourse of Jesus. It runs through chapter 24 and through chapter 25. Quite a long session. And we'll spend a wee bit of time on this because there's a lot in it. So let's pick up in verses 1, 2, and 3. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple where he'd been doing all of this teaching and so on. Remember, he cleansed the temple and so on. His disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple, which apparently were magnificent. Something like 500 yards long and 400 yards across. Lots of white marble, lots of gold plates, so that when the sun was rising or setting, the whole temple would glow with a sort of golden glow. Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And Jesus said to them, all right, do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. Which would have been sort of like, huh? They're looking at this massive structure with all the courtyards and the actual temple itself, the sanctuary part, and it's beautiful, and it's been being built for something like 30, 40 years at this stage. And Jesus says it's going to be thrown down and not even two stones will survive. Wow. Stunning. Verse 3, now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So really there's sort of two questions there. Tell us, when will these things be? In other words, this time when the temple's going to be destroyed and no stones left together. And secondly, I guess, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of this age? And because this took place here on the Mount of Olives, where Jesus was sitting down, it's referred to typically as the Olivet discourse, or sometimes the Olivet prophecy. So there's two quite different questions here. And then people start to wonder, you can see why, probably we've all wondered this, which part of this prophecy relates to the early part when the temple was destroyed? And which parts of this discourse relate to the end of the age when Jesus returns? Because sometimes they seem to blur a little bit. And it's not always that easy to sort of quite discern one from another. And on top of that, we can contrast with Mark 13 and Luke 21, where we also find the Olivet prophecy. Now, we'll be looking at Luke in a moment. Mark is very, very similar to Matthew 24. Mark 13, very similar to Matthew 24. Not much difference there. But Luke 21 is a wee bit different. It might help us to just try and grasp which parts of Jesus' answer refer to what's past, historic, took place a long time ago, and which parts of Matthew 24 might relate to us today? Which way round does it work? Now notice verse 3, it says, as Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us. Well, this is not therefore addressed to the multitudes any longer. This is a private discussion for the disciples. But actually, it's even more private than that. Hold your place there just for a moment and look at Mark 13, verses 1 to 4. Mark chapter 13, the Olivet prophecy part. Then as he went out of the temple, verse 1, one of the disciples said to him, Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. And Jesus answered and said to him, Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, opposite the temple, that would be across the valley, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, saying, Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled? So actually, there's only four disciples heard this firsthand. Peter, James and John, and Andrew. So it wasn't actually even given to the 12 disciples. You know, for example, Judas wasn't there and so on. So let's go back to Matthew 24. And let's read through verses 4 through 8. So they said, when shall these things be? That must mean the throwing over of the temple stones. And what's the sign of your coming? And they might have thought they were going to happen together, but I think we all know by now there's a bit of a gap there. Verse 4, Jesus answered and said to them, Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. So the first warning is deception. Now bear in mind he's talking to Peter, James and John, and Andrew, who I think we know are the elect among the elect. They were the ones that Jesus took with him to a number of very private places, like the Mount of Transfiguration, when he went in to heal Jairus' daughter. It was just these two, three, four guys. And Jesus says, Watch out that you are not going to be deceived. For many will come, many will come, many will come in my name, saying that Christ will deceive many, many, many. So you and I, shouldn't be too complacent. Deception is prophesied. Verse 6, And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of sorrows. So we've got that. Deception, wars, famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places, and these are described, verse 8, as the beginning of sorrows. Now, the word sorrows is better translated birth pangs. Birth pangs. And the NET translation, the New American Standard Bible, the RSV, translated as birth pangs. Okay. Now, we're going to sort of go to Luke in a moment before we get much further, but notice these various things, deception and rumors of war and famines and so on, are birth pangs, right? Birth pangs. What Matthew then talks about is what happens after the birth pangs. Notice verse 9 says, Then, so we get the birth pangs. Verse 9 says, Then they will do something. Verse 10 says, And then many will be offended. Verse 11 says, Then many false prophets. Drop down to verse 16. Then let those in Judea flee. verse 21, for then will be great tribulation. Verse 29, immediately after the tribulation. So you've got the birth pangs mentioned here by Matthew, and then he talks about things that appear to be all happening afterward, after the birth pangs, then, after the tribulation. So it appears to me, I'm going to suggest, that Matthew's Olivet discourse focuses on the end time events, because everything is going to happen then, after the birth pangs. So the main themes in Matthew's version are the end of the age, basically our time today, the Great Tribulation, Jesus' return. Now, keep that thought in mind as we turn to Luke. So we go to Luke chapter 21. I think we'll see there's a bit of a different emphasis in Luke 21. And that means it's important not necessarily to confuse what we did in Luke, which is very similar to what we read in Matthew 24. So Luke 21, let's pick up in verse 5. Verses 5 through 7 to start with, Luke 21. Then as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, as for these things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. Well, we've read that already, that's fine. And they asked him, saying, Teacher, when will these things be? And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place? Ah, well, that's only really the first question. When is it going to happen? You've just described, you know, Lord, Rabbi, the destruction of this beautiful temple. When? What will the signs be? So unlike Matthew, where they also asked and Jesus answered, what about your return? The question here is only about when's the destruction going to take place? And I think you'll see as we go on that that's what Luke focuses on, the 70 AD fulfillment. It's a different emphasis. Let's read verses 8 through 11. And he said, Take heed that you not be deceived, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and the time has drawn near, therefore do not go after them. When you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately. He said to them, Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes in various places, and famines, and pestilences. There will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. Now, we just read all that in Matthew. That was described as the birth pangs, wasn't it? You know, the wars, the rumours, the earthquakes, the famines, the pestilences, these are the birth pangs. And then, Matthew said, then, after. But notice a distinction here, because having mentioned the birth pangs, Luke now focuses on what happens before that. Verse 12, but before all these things. Before. So from this verse here, right through to verse 24, we're going to read that now since we're in Luke 21. Luke is emphasizing and focusing on the before the birth pangs. Matthew on what happens after the birth pangs. So let's pick it up. And I think as we read through it, you'll see that, yep, this pretty much describes the early destruction of the temple. That's the question that was posed here in verse 7. You know, what's the sign of these things happening? And here's the answer. Verse 12, but before all these things, the birth pangs, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons, and you'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, Settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will send some of you to your death. And you'll be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. In your patience and your endurance, possess your souls. Verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. Now notice in verse 20 there, when you see the armies heading towards Jerusalem and encircling it, you know its desolation is near. Now the question was, Jesus having said the temple is going to be destroyed, no stones left upon each other. The question is, when? What signs? Well, here's the answer, guys. Verse 20. When you see the armies encircling Jerusalem, know its desolation is upon you. And verse 20, then, when you see those armies, let those in Judea flee to the mountains. They'll stay there. It's going to be destroyed. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. Let not those who are in the country enter her, for these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people, the Jews of Jerusalem. They will fall by the edge of the sword, be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And that happened in 70 AD. in 70 AD, well, starting a few years earlier than that, the Roman Emperor, having got a bit fed up with the Jews, who were at times quite revolting, and had yet another revolt underway, Emperor Nero, as it was, sent one of his generals into Palestine to settle things down, to restore order. That was about 66 or so AD. Emperor Nero died sort of early on in the story, and the general he'd sent to Palestine, General Vespasian, stopped his attacks and returned to Rome. In fact, he ended up becoming the new emperor, Emperor Vespasian. So he got as far as subduing the northern part of Palestine, sort of Galilee and the towns around there. But once Nero died, he left, went back to Rome, and left his son Titus to carry on subduing the rest of the land of Israel. And so by the time you get to 70 AD, Titus and the armies have surrounded Rome, surrounded sort of Jerusalem, and they destroyed it. According to Josephus, the historian of the day, Titus and his soldiers slaughtered 1.1 million people. Now that's a lot today for the much smaller population of the earth. In sort of 70 AD, that's like killing, 50 million today? That's a lot of people, 1.1 million men and women and children. Those who weren't slaughtered were taken off as captives in the main, dispersed among the nations, just like Jesus said there, verse 24, they will fall by the edge of the sword, about 1 million or more, and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled down. The temple itself was completely destroyed. You'll see today sometimes on the news what the Jews refer to as the Wailing Wall, or the Western Wall, and you'll see the Jews sort of praying in front of it and putting little written prayers into the sort of crevices and the stones there. Well, you might say, well, didn't Jesus say not one stone left upon another? I mean, there's hundreds of huge stones there, all perfectly joined together. It's like a complete big wall. Well, it turns out, in practice, that's probably not the temple at all. That's probably part of the Roman fort of the day. That's a different story. It does seem the temple itself was completely overturned, destroyed, and no more. And if you think about it, that not only brings about the death of 1 million Jews, the captivity and slavery of many thousands of others, it actually brought to an end the Jewish religious system, as it was, because the temple's finished. No temple, no sacrifices, no priesthood, no Levites. So after all those centuries, the temple worship of the Jewish people came to an end, and it hasn't come back since. So quite dramatic. And that's what Jesus was saying there. You know, the days are coming. Jerusalem, that's why he wept. The days are coming, only 40 or so years later, when this city that I so often wanted to reach and protect will be emptied, desolate, destroyed, horrendously, cruelly, and it will be emptied for many, many centuries. That's why Jesus wept. But notice in verse 25, we now seem to jump in Luke's account. So he's answered the question, Jesus. When's it going to happen? What are the signs? Here they are. All focusing on the first destruction of 70 AD. Verse 25, we seem to jump to the future. And there will be signs in the sun, in the moon, in the stars, and on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them from fear, and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then, they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Well, that's not happened yet. And when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. So, okay, let's go back to Matthew 24 now. And with that sort of an interlude there about the 70 AD destruction, question one answered, we can now read Matthew 24 and see that almost certainly Matthew is referring to the end time events. Remember the questions, plural here, in verse 3 were, when will these things be, the destruction, and what will be the sign of your coming? That's different. So, pick up in verses 6 through 8. You'll hear wars and rumors of wars. Don't be troubled. All these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. Famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places, all these are the beginning of birth pangs. Luke then explained what would happen before that. Matthew now seems to focus on what's going to happen after that. Verse 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my namesake, and many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Now, just watch out for the word offended there. You know, sometimes offense is just being, you know, rude. You know, somebody says, you put some weight on, haven't you? Oh, I'm offended. You know, it's not talking of that type of offense. It's talking about stumbling. The New American Standard Bible says, and then many will fall away. The Weymouth says, many will stumble and fall. So that's probably a little bit more accurate. So verse 10, then many will fall away from the truth, will betray one another, will hate one another. Then, and I'm going to suggest this is at the end of the age now, then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. This is the end we're talking about here. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, plural, and then the end will come. So again, to me at least, this is suggested we're talking about something at the end of the age. The gospel being preached in the whole world to all the nations, plural, and when that's done, then the end will come. Now, you could say, has that been done so far? Not sure how God's going to measure the effectiveness of the preaching of the gospel. Clearly, a gospel, some gospels, and various gospels have been preached for a couple of thousand years now. But there could be yet another component to this, because hold your place there. Just look at Revelation 14, verses 6 to 7, because there's a further episode of the gospel yet to be preached. No matter how much we as human beings, organizations, ministries, churches, whatever, no matter how much we do a job there, look at Revelation 14 and read verses 6 and 7. Set in the future, and it says here, it talks of three angels with three messages, and their end time messages. Verse 6, then I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. Okay, there's an angel who has the everlasting gospel to proclaim to every nation and every language. Sing with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and springs of water. So there is a yet future proclamation, maybe supernatural. I've heard people saying, well, maybe the angel, the word angel means messenger. Maybe this is some sort of a satellite in the heavens that's broadcasting. I don't know. Sounds a wee bit far-fetched. I suppose possible. One way or another, there is the gospel yet to be preached effectively at the very end time from this angel. And we can tell it's the end time because verse 8 says, another angel says, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Well, that's not happened yet. And then the third angel, not going to read it, but just basically warns those not to worship the beast or take his mark. It's all end time. Okay, back to Matthew 24. So, to me, Matthew is very clearly focusing on the end of the age and Jesus' return. And there's very little, if anything, about 70 AD. Luke apparently covers that part off. Then we get to the very interesting verse 15. And therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, brackets, whoever reads, let him understand, so nod, nod, wink, wink. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. And you better do it urgently, because verse 17 says, let him who's on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Let him who's in the field not go back to get his outer garments, his clothes, because it's dangerous. Just as in 70 AD, you know, as the armies of the Roman armies were heading towards Jerusalem, some of the historians of the day, Eusebius is one of them, says that the approaching armies paused for a while. And in that time when they didn't carry on marching and it was quiet for a little bit, all those that knew Jesus' words, recorded by Luke, about when you see the armies know the desolation is near, that the believers, the Christians who believed Jesus' words, took off in a hurry. And I went up to a small town called Pella in the North Jordan Valley. And then after a short pause, the armies came down again, circled the city, destroyed it. If you're still there, you're dead or a slave. But those who believed the prophecies, they'd escaped in that little pause that happened earlier because they had the words of Jesus recorded in Luke 21. But of course, we're now talking about the end, not way back in those days. And Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet in the holy place, get out of there in a hurry and do it urgently. That's his instructions. Well, there's a couple of things there. obviously, Jesus appears to believe there's a prophet called Daniel, more than some people do today. So Jesus confirms the existence of Daniel as an important prophet. And again, it tells us, hang on, we better make sure we know our Old Testament, because it says, understand what Daniel, the prophet, was on about. How can you do that if you're purely a New Testament Christian? Well, the answer is obviously you can't. And there's lots of things we need to understand from the former writings. I don't even like the term Old Testament. New Testament, because people think old is no use, and worn out and replaced. So it's not. You know, it's the former writings and the latter writings. It's the early part of the book and the latter part of the book. It's not old and new in that sense. But we do need to read the book of Daniel to find out what on earth would this abomination of desolation be. Yeah. You can see a couple of things just from the words themselves. Abomination just means something that's foul and detestable. Simple as that. It's abominable. It's a stench. It's foul, detestable. The Jews typically used it to refer to things like sacrilegious idols. To them, that would be foul, detestable, and abominable. And obviously, it says the abomination of desolation. Well, to desolate means to destroy. So here's some foul, detestable, possibly sacrilegious idol that brings about destruction. That's what the words suggest, but what did Daniel say about it, I wonder? Then it says, and Jesus says, when you see it standing in the holy place. Well, there is no holy place today, because the holy place was part of the temple. Potentially, the actual sanctuary part. So what does that imply? It may imply that a temple or tabernacle or some tent-type structure is yet to be erected in Jerusalem, where the Jews will be able to commence sacrifices, which will then get stopped. Because we're going to turn to Daniel in a moment or two, but Daniel, which Jesus refers us back to, it does talk about two things: a historic abomination of desolation, as well as he prophesies of a future abomination of desolation. And the historical one that did take place, we need to look at the life and times of an individual called Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus, if you're a note taker, is A-N-T-I-O-C-H-U-S, Antiochus, and then Epiphanes, E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S, Antiochus Epiphanes. He adds the word Epiphanes himself. It means like God manifest. So when you look at me, guys, you're looking at, God manifest. Aren't you impressed? Apparently, he was known by other people as Antiochus Epimenes, E-P-I-M-A-N-E-S, which means the madman. So some of his folk of that day didn't... I mean, it sounds the same, doesn't it? Epiphanes, Epimenes. So it's a bit of play on the sound, but it means, Antiochus the madman. And he came to power in 175 BC, a long, long time ago, and he was one of the successors to Alexander the Great after his empire sort of collapsed. So I'm going to read a couple of historical comments that I picked up off of the famous intranet about this individual, because he's pretty well known to the Jews. And he appears to be, if you like, that first prototype of the abomination of desolation. Here we go. In 168 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes outlawed Judaism. This is me interjecting now. He was having a number of wars with Egypt, And if you're coming from the north to fight in Egypt and vice versa, you come through Palestine, through the land of Israel. And he didn't like what he saw there, so he outlawed Judaism. He went about destroying synagogues and massacring thousands. So if you're a Jew, you'd have seen him as a pretty nasty piece of work. Only the Jews were here, by the way. Don't forget the house of Israel had gone missing 500 years before. Carrying on. In 168 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes thought he had solved the Jewish problem. His troops had leveled the walls of Jerusalem, and he erected a huge fortress known as Acra in the temple area for the use of his Greek troops. Epiphanes had made up his mind to entirely obliterate the Jewish religion. So this guy, I mean, you have to assume, I guess, that Satan is so behind this. You're gonna eliminate the Jewish religion? He declared their constitution, the Torah, to be null and void. So all the laws in the Torah, all 613 commandments or whatever, null and void. He forbade the observance of the religious customs, especially keeping Sabbath, circumcision, and the dietary laws. Now, if you're going to stop the Jews circumcising their boys and force them to eat unclean foods and telling them to desecrate the Sabbath, and you're trying to eliminate Jewish religion, Jewish culture, the Jewish nation. On the other hand, he enforced the adoption of the Greek state religion. The Jews were forced to sacrifice to the Greek gods. In order to compel them to follow the Greek religion, he made them sacrifice unclean animals, particularly pigs, on pagan altars. Greek officials were sent throughout the entire nation to rigidly enforce the new religion. The slightest show of resistance was punished by death. Synagogues were destroyed, sacred scrolls of the law were desecrated, and people massacred by the thousands. So generally a bad time to be a Jew. To top these calamities, and this is where you get to the abomination part, to top these calamities, the temple in Jerusalem was rededicated to the Greek god Zeus. A statue of Zeus was set up in the temple, right in the most holy place. Pigs were slain on the altar of God in the temple. This was the horrible abomination that causes desolation spoken of by Daniel. So that's one little historian's summary. Another one, just another short one. After being humiliated and forced to leave Egypt, Antiochus's vengeance was quickly turned upon Jerusalem. He killed over 80,000 men, women, and children, and sold 40,000 into slavery. The holy place was robbed of its treasures, and the temple was dedicated to Jupiter Olympus. The temple was defiled by offering a sow upon the altar and scattering its juice over all the sanctuary and vessels. He substituted the Jewish feasts with the drunken revelry of Bacchanalia, forcing the Jews to worship Bacchus, the god of pleasure and wine. The licentious festival of Saturnalia, the worship of Saturn, was also enforced upon the inhabitants. He forbade the reading of holy scriptures and the tradition of circumcision, and a few more details about the brutality. So that's Antiochus Epiphanes. In 168 BC, he sacrificed pig's blood in the Holy of Holies and set up a idolatrous statue to the god Zeus. And implications are, we can expect something along that line somewhere in the future. So let's look at what Daniel says now. That's the background historically. Look first at Daniel 11, and start in verse 21. Because Jesus said, the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Let us understand. So let's look at Daniel the prophet, like Jesus said. And we pick up here Daniel 11, and verse 21. So Daniel 11 is a long prophecy given to Daniel by the angel. That's the previous chapter. So it says from God, through the angel, to Daniel. Daniel's recording. This is a very long prophecy in Daniel chapter 11. And it covers lots of people, personalities, wars, murders, things of that nature. It is so accurate that lots of skeptical people say it wasn't written by Daniel, because Daniel lived around about 500 odd BC. These events we're about to read here are 160 odd BC. Daniel's been dead centuries. So they're saying, well, hang on. Daniel 11 must have been written by somebody other than Daniel much later on, because it's just too accurate it must be written as a historical chapter. Well, the answer is no. God gave the prophecy to the angel, gave it to Daniel. Jesus said, check out Daniel and his prophecy. So here we are, verse 31. And in his place, talking of the previous king, shall arise a vile person. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. We're just entering Daniel 11 when Antiochus appears in the scene in verse 21. In his place, previous king, shall arise a vile person. I think one translation says a contemptible person. That's your man, the madman. To whom they will not give the honour of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So there's a couple of hints that when we get to the end of the age, the man who's going to cause all the troubles will come in peaceably as a peacemaker, but actually will then, true colours will come through. We'll miss out a few verses talking about Antiochus' adventures in Egypt. Let's drop down to verses 28 to 35. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart will be moved against the Holy Covenant. He's furious with the Jewish people. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus, my Bible says, I think the Hebrew is Kittim, K-I-T-T-I-M, K-I-T-T-I-M, that signifies Rome in prophecy. So for ships from Rome shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So partly some Jews were willing to give up the religion to curry favor with Antiochus. Verse 31, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. And then notice, they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. So in 168 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes takes away the sacrifices and establishes in that place, in this sanctuary, the abomination of desolation. This is the history, but this appears to be, if you like, a forerunner, an outline of what's going to happen again. Daily sacrifices stopped, abomination of desolation set up, which at this time was the statue of Zeus or of Jupiter Olympus, and the shedding of a pig's blood over God's altars. Verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue, flattery, stealth, dishonesty, and some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purge them, and make them white until the time of the end. Because it is still for the appointed time. So even this passage talking of Antiochus setting up this abomination of desolation in the sanctuary and cancelling the sacrifices, even this passage seems to point to the end time, doesn't it? The end time, the time of the end. Let's look now at Daniel 12, because that's one reference there to the abomination of desolation. There's more than one in Daniel. The next one is in Daniel 12. Let's get verses 1 and 2 for some context. And Daniel 11 was historic. That's what did happen. That's the forerunner, if you like, or sometimes people talk of types and anti-types. Well, that was it. But Daniel 12 is future. Daniel 12, 1 and 2. 1 and 2. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. Now that's ahead of us. And at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Is this future? Yeah. This is right up to Jesus' return and the resurrection of the saints. Future, future, future. We're not there yet. So dropping down then to verses 9 to 13. And the angel said, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white, and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." Verse 11, the big verse, "And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Now, this is future. This is the time of the end. This isn't Antiochus. It may have it may play out with some similarities, but this is the time of the end. The angel just said, you know, it's sealed till the end time. Verse 12, "Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days, but you, Daniel, go your way till the end, for you shall rest and will rise to your inheritance at the end of the days." That's the resurrection of Daniel and the rest of the saints at the end of the days. This abomination of desolation and the taking away of the daily sacrifice is in the end time.
What did you tell me?
And we haven't got sacrifices yet in Jerusalem. They've got to be reestablished in some sort of structure, temple, tabernacle, tent. There's going to be something with an altar and sacrifices. And let's look now at the last place in Daniel, Daniel 9, verses 26 to 27. Daniel 9, verses 26 to 27. Daniel 9, starting a few verses earlier, includes a prophecy about Jesus at his first coming. And then when we get to verse 26, it talks about Jesus being crucified. It says, "After the 62 weeks, not covering that, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself." That's true. The number of... In Daniel 9, you've got this scenario where a week is 7 days, representing sort of 7 years in prophecy. So there's a total of 490 days or prophetic years being mentioned. So ignore all that because it's too complicated for now. But verse 26, "After the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, crucified, executed, but not for himself," because he died for the sins of the world. But then notice, this is where it gets quite interesting, "And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary will..." Right, this is something that is going to be yet future. "The people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he," And I believe that's this prince who is to come, this individual like Antiochus was a type. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. Now my margin says treaty. So this individual is going to establish a treaty, a covenant, with many, probably the Jewish nation, for 1 week or 7 years. It's a prophecy. But in the middle of the week, that's 3.5 years into it, in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Ooh. So remember the abomination of desolation? You stop the sacrifices, you erect an abomination. And here it tells us that what we're looking at appears to be this individual entering into a 7-year treaty or covenant with the Jewish nation, Israel today, the state of Israel. But halfway through that 7 years, he brings an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wings of abominations shall be one who makes desolate. So that's your abomination part of desolation. Even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. The Good News Bible translates that as the abomination will be placed on the highest point of the temple. The NIV says, will place abominations on a wing of the temple until the end. So that gives us a bit more of a clue, in a sense, as to what's likely to happen here. What we seem to be seeing is an individual who comes on the world scene peaceably, as Antiochus appeared to come in. But then, well, I guess at some point, this leader acquires sufficient political capital from whatever he's doing to be able to sign up a very important 7-year treaty with the state of Israel. But then, halfway through it, in the midst of it, he stops the Israelis from carrying out their sacrifices and erects an abomination in that holy place. And that final 3.5 years, so 7 years, halfway through it, stop the sacrifices, erect the abomination, that final 3.5 years is the Great Tribulation. So when we see this individual appear on the scene, if we recognize him early on, then we can watch out, because he's going to change. Initially peaceably, but he's actually a vile and contemptible person. So let's go back to Matthew 24. Just round up with a few verses before we close for today. So verse 15, Matthew 24, verse 15. And we read down perhaps for today, we'll see how far we get. So Jesus says, when you see, it will be something we can all see, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads them understand, and I think that's halfway through the 7-year treaty, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who's in the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Let him who's in the field not go back. It's dangerous. It's going to be destruction. Get out of there now while you can. Verse 19. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those with nursing babies in those days. Pray your flight may not be in the winter and the Sabbath. For then, once the abomination is in place, then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time. No, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. We're not there yet. Once the abomination is up, you know that, you know, the worst is about to happen. Because we've all read about and perhaps seen some pictures of the Second World War and the Jewish Holocaust, the First World War, Stalin killing between 20 and 60 million people, Mao Zedong killing 45 million people, etc., etc. There's been destruction, pain, misery, torture, brutality, mountains and mountains of bodies. There's worse to come. This is, well, Jesus says, there's never been a time like it, and if it wasn't cut short, nobody would survive. That's how bad it is. And it happens after the abomination that Daniel talks about is set up. Carrying on, for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened, and thank God for that. Then, at that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, don't believe it, for false Christs, false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. It's going to be pretty strong deception. See, I've told you beforehand, I'm warning you. Peter, Andrew, James, John, I'm warning you guys. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he's in the desert, don't go out. Look, he's in the inner rooms, don't believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, in other words, visibly, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. And I guess that's probably a fair place to sort of finish for today. So we'll pick up the story again next week.